This is Macro Voices with hedge fund manager Eric Townsend, the free weekly financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Macro Voices is all about the brightest minds in the world of finance and macroeconomics telling it like it is, bullish or bearish, no holds barred. Now, here are your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Serezna.
Macro Voices, episode 268, was recorded on April 22nd, 2021. I'm Eric Townsend. This episode is brought to you by Abex Technologies, pioneering the design of smarter markets that better meet the needs of both market participants and society as a whole. And by Abra Silver Resource Corporation, a premier emerging silver and gold exploration company, ticker ABRA on TSX Venture and ABBRF in the United States. It's time for a crude oil special, and petroleum geologist Art Berman is back as this week's feature interview guest. Art nailed the call for $65 crude oil this year when we had him on in early January, but now Art says the big move higher in price is probably mostly over, and he doesn't really see any reason to expect crude oil prices to rally much higher than $70 this year. And that's despite the fact that Art still predicts a significant decline in U.S. production later this year. We'll discuss all of that and much more in this week's feature interview. Then be sure to stay tuned for our post-game segment when Patrick's chart deck will keep the energy theme going with an examination of energy equities.
And I'm Patrick Serezna. Now, Eric, the S&P 500 started this week just backfilling after almost 3 weeks of straight up. We've really just been consolidating, but it's not been a really deep sell-off by any means. Do you think there's something more to this, or is just the market taking a pause?
Nah, never even got below the short-term moving averages. Touched the 13 yesterday, and now we're bouncing back off of it. So I don't really have any change in my view, which is, on one hand, I do think that the market is very overvalued here, but I think we have an Austrian crack-up boom in process, and I think that markets are likely to continue melting up higher. The downside risk is significant, though. If I were going to play this market at all, I would play it with options, probably on a straddle strategy.
All right, well, let's move on to that U.S. dollar index, because the last 2 weeks, the Dixie has been really just throwing back. We hit a low of near 91, a little bit off of its lows in the last few days. Do you think the U.S. dollar could resume an up move, or is it over for the dollar?
I think anything's possible here. You know, 92 was the logical resistance level because that had been support on the way down. And we kind of powered right through it. I think that was probably a short squeeze that took us through it. Now we've been below it for long enough to, I think, declare that breakout as a fake breakout. Does that mean it's going, you know, much lower from here? I really have no idea, Patrick. My focus really has been on the real purchasing power of all fiat currency going down, not up.
All right, well, let's move on to crude oil, because crude oil has had a couple of days pulling back off that 64 high. Do you think there's more to this correction?
You know, I said last week that it just felt too easy, and that's the nagging feeling that I've had, Patrick. I just can't shake it. It feels to me like this wasn't painful enough for us oil bulls. So on one hand, if you look at what the tape action's doing, even with the big sell-off today, we're still inside the boundaries of a new upward sloping channel, which apparently, you know, the breakout is still in process. We're at the bottom of that channel now, and if we were to see a closing print below the 55-day moving average, which is right now at 60.84, that would say that that new channel did not hold, that this upside breakout has failed, and that we're headed lower. And although I do not see anything in terms of chart indications that tells me that that's happening yet, I still can't shake this nagging feeling that we got off easy in terms of this correction just wasn't painful enough for the bulls. I wouldn't be surprised if there's still another leg to a newer low ahead of us.
So, Eric, how did the oil inventories come in this week?
Patrick, crude oil drew down 594,000 barrels, so it was a drawdown, but a small drawdown. Cushing, Oklahoma, drawing down 1.3 million barrels. Gasoline, building, but only 86,000 barrels. And distillates, drawing down 1.1 million barrels. Meanwhile, U.S. production holding steady at 11 million barrels. I'm going to save any color perspective on the market for Art Berman, since that's our feature interview today. We'll come back in the post game, though, because there are a few areas where I disagree slightly with Art.
All right, well, let's move on to gold. We came a hairline away from printing 1800 on the upside of gold. A little bit of a pullback today as we're recording. Do you think that this is a meaningful turn in gold here for the last couple weeks?
I do think it's a meaningful turn, and frankly, I think that today's pullback is perfectly natural and nothing to be concerned about. The balance of evidence has now shifted to where the more likely scenario is that a new uptrend is in play. It's still a little bit early. As you've said a couple of times, it would be nice to get above that 100-day moving average at 1806, or even just above the round number resistance at 1800. But I think it's coming, Patrick. The big test was getting above both the channel resistance, the short-term moving averages, and we broke very decisively above them. So if there's going to be a change of heart here, I think it will be an interest rate-driven change of heart. In other words, if the U.S. 10-year yield backs up to 2% or something, I think it's going to clobber the gold market really hard. Short of that happening, it looks to me like the bottom's probably in.
All right, well, let's touch on that bond market. The 10-year Treasury yield spent the first quarter of the year just roaring higher. We obviously got almost up to a 1.80 on the yield. And really, since then, most of April has just been backfilling. I mean, we're right now at about a 1.56 yield. Do you think this consolidation continues, or is there more upside for yields?
Patrick, I really don't know where this is headed, and frankly, I'm not sure that anybody does. The figuring out where the direction of Treasury yields is headed is a very complex problem in this very complex market with so many policy decisions pending and change of presidential administration, so many things going on. What I will say is this is the important thing to watch. You got to keep your eye glued to the 10-year yield. If we do see it continue to break higher, particularly if we break through 2% and keep moving higher in yield, it really could cause a lot of damage in a lot of other markets. So it's going to be really important to watch. But as far as a directional call, I don't have one here.
Well, this week's feature interview guest is petroleum geologist Art Berman. Now, Eric, why did we get Art back on the show this week?
We've had lots of requests to get Art back, and you know, it's barely been a little more than 3 months since we had him on the show as our first show of 2021, actually. He was our first feature interview guest, and he nailed the call at the time. He was calling for $65 crude oil before the year was over. Everybody thought that sounded crazy too high, and of course, we've already been there. But he's changed his tune quite a bit, and we've gotten a lot of feedback from listeners saying, hey, Art's changing his tune. You guys got to get him back on the show for another update. So it was time to bring him back, and that's what we did.
Well, Eric's interview with Art Berman is coming up as Macro Voices continues right after this message from our sponsor.
This episode of Macro Voices was made possible by Abex Technologies. In addition to sponsoring Macro Voices, Abex also produces Smarter Markets, a podcast that airs every Saturday morning. Smarter Markets brings together the leading minds in macroeconomics, technology, and commodities to explore how capital markets can be redesigned to better serve market participants and society as a whole. Michelle Dennity's second episode of Smarter Markets is now live at smartermarketspod.com and features an interview with fellow cybersecurity mastermind Carolyn Wong, Chief Strategy Officer at Cobalt. This Saturday, I'll be back on Smarter Markets to introduce Michelle's co-host this season, Todd Buchholz. Todd is a world-renowned economist and has served as both White House Director of Economic Policy under George H.W. Bush and Managing Director of the acclaimed Tiger Hedge Fund. But you won't get Smarter Markets on your Macro Voices feed. You have to subscribe separately to Smarter Markets in your podcast app to receive this free podcast.
And now, with this week's special guest, here's hedge fund manager Eric Townsend.
Joining me now is petroleum geologist Art Berman, who, as always, has prepared one of his terrific slide decks to accompany today's interview. Registered users will find the download link in your Research Roundup email. If you don't have a Research Roundup email, that means you're not registered yet at macrovoices.com. Just go to the homepage, macrovoices.com, look for the red button that says Looking for the Downloads just above Art's picture. Art, it's great to get you back on the show and to dive into another of your slide decks, but let's start with the big picture. Last time we talked to you, you had been projecting a decline in U.S. production, which was running a little bit late. You said it might run even later than that, but you thought it was still coming at that point. And at that time, when we had you on in January, I think oil was in the 30s. You said it could go to 65 this year, and everybody thought you were crazy because that number was too high. And of course, we got there not in the remaining 12 months of the year, but within the next 12 weeks, we got to that number. So congratulations on getting a couple of calls right. But let's get the update. What do you see from here?
Right. Well, a couple of things, Eric. First, I'm going to apologize for my voice. I had a little surgery. It doesn't sound as bad as it sounds, at least for me, but listeners will have to forgive me. Yeah. So, you know, diving into, you know, the end of my slide deck, if you like to, on slide 7, I haven't changed this chart since our January discussion. The only thing I've added, which is to say I haven't changed my outlook. Now, I understand that, you know, people are sure I'm wrong because production is still hanging in there at, you know, upper 10 to lower 11 million barrels per day. And I may be wrong. And, you know, anybody could be wrong. But the way I look at this is, you know, you got to drill wells to get a certain level of production. Whatever you think about, you know, the time shifting and all of that in this chart, you know, we're at 323 oil-directed rigs as of March. And we had been between 800 and 900 to support 11 million barrels per day. So, you know, simple math, you don't have to be a petroleum geologist, says, you know, you're less than half the number of rigs you need to support the production that everybody thinks is going to keep on going. And unless there's been some kind of, you know, absolutely magical technological breakthrough that I don't know about, I just don't see how it can happen. You know, you just don't have enough, you don't have enough gas in the tank to get you there. Now, obviously, the part I could be wrong on is when's it going to happen? Because, I mean, I don't honestly know. I don't think anybody really knows, you know, how many wells are being completed each month. The best we can do is the EIA drilling productivity report, which I study and analyze pretty carefully. And it tells me that, you know, the rig count is still a darn good proxy for well completions and et cetera. So, you know, I'm sticking to my story, Eric.
Art, what you're showing here is an expectation that a deviation from the EIA outlook is going to occur, a downside deviation. And you're saying here that if the base case proves true, that deviation doesn't start till sometime in June. If the low case proves true, it might start in May, and it's not till July if it's the high case. I guess what I'm struggling with, Art, is, you know, we first talked about this. Originally, you were expecting this decline to occur, I think, almost a full year ago. So is there room for this to keep slipping, or what is the factor that's allowed it to keep slipping beyond your initial expectations?
Yeah, well, it hasn't kept slipping, Eric. When we originally talked, all I was doing was using tight oil rig count to project the whole thing out. And I was following a fairly religious rig count correlation with production. And by the time we spoke in January, I'd expanded the study to include all wells in the U.S., conventional, unconventional, offshore, the whole thing. And that's where this particular chart came from, which, as I said, hasn't changed. So nothing slipping since January. And as I, you know, said in the beginning here, my timing can be wrong, but there's just no way that you can have less than half the wells that were producing the level that you think we're going to be at and continue to produce that level unless something, you know, very magical is happening that I don't, and, you know, nobody's told me about.
I'm just trying to assimilate here what you're actually projecting, because on one hand, it seems like you're very much still committed to the idea that U.S. production should decline fairly steeply later on this year. And I guess what I'm having a hard time reconciling is I would have expected that prediction to come accompanied with a higher price forecast. And I know you're not projecting a higher price. You're saying maybe it's a little bit overdone where it already is. So why would we not expect prices to continue to increase if there is this market surprise or a deviation from consensus expectations that we end up with lower U.S. production than everybody is expecting us to have?
Well, that's a great question. And let me just, you know, emphasize that, you know, in the three cases, I mean, I'm talking about, let's take the base case, which is, you know, 9 million a day, and the high case, which is almost 10 million a day. So, you know, you keep saying that, you know, production's going to fall off a cliff. Well, you know, it's 10.7 or so right now. And so, yeah, I mean, it's going to drop a million barrels a day, maybe a million and a half. I mean, that's a lot. I'm not trying to minimize it. But, I mean, it's not like we're, you know, I'm saying that it's going to go to zero. It's a more substantial drop than, you know, than EIA and most other forecasters are talking about. So your second question is, why am I not more bullish on price? Well, you just, when you introduced me, you said I was, my 65 forecast was more bullish than anybody, or not. I know you agreed and you were actually more bullish than I was, but than the mainstream view. And so the rest of my slides support that position. And so the Cliff Notes summary is that because U.S. production isn't the world, and because OPEC's got, you know, 8.5 million barrels a day sitting in its back pocket, and everybody knows that. And I suppose we can, you know, we can debate how long that 8.5 million barrels of spare capacity may or may not last, et cetera, et cetera. But bottom line is, you know, the market's cheap. And, you know, why would the market pay $80 or $90 a barrel when it knows that the supply is there? And so if we go back and we look at previous periods where price got to 80 or 90 barrels, which, by the way, has not happened since 2014. So we got 6 years under our belt where, you know, the highest monthly average price is not anywhere near $80 a barrel, which is Goldman's forecast for third quarter. And so again, you know, I can turn it around and say, well, tell me what's different. And the only thing that's different is that OPEC's withholding a ton of supply from the market, and the market knows it. So what's the panic about?
Art, let's take a look at your spare capacity chart, which is on slide 4 of the chart deck. And as you're showing here, OPEC's spare capacity is 11 times, as you put it, greater than the last time Brent was $80. I want to ask you to explain this chart. I have a few of my own thoughts, but I want to start with your explanation. Give us the background on what this chart is telling us.
Sure, Eric. So this chart shows EIA's estimate of the production that OPEC could bring to the market within, you know, like 2 or 3 months if they wanted to. I think that's how EIA defines it. I've taken this chart all the way back to 1993, which is the beginning of information about spare capacity that's publicly available. And the picture doesn't change a whole lot. And so, as you know, and I think most of our listeners know, until the so-called shale revolution, when OPEC spare capacity got below about 4 million barrels a day, markets kind of freaked out and price went way up. And if you look at this chart and you see on the left-hand side, you know, price goes, this is Brent, from about $60 in the beginning of 2010 to $123 in the middle of 2011. That corresponds quite nicely with OPEC spare capacity dropping from over 4 million barrels a day to 2 million barrels a day. That was standard procedure back before there was shale. So what we see then, looking farther toward the present, about 80% to the right, you see just below where the title OPEC spare capacity sits, that was the last time that Brent got to more than $80, $81 a barrel in November 2018. Look down at spare capacity. That's the lowest spare capacity on record, less than a million barrels a day, 800,000 barrels a day. Again, that's a guesstimate, and I don't really care about the absolute number, but it shows, you know, kind of relatively what's going on. Fast forward to the present, and we're sitting at the highest spare capacity in history of, you know, 8.5 to, you know, right now in March, to 9.2 in the middle of last year. And so, I mean, there's just absolutely nothing about the historical correlation between OPEC spare capacity and price that says that price maybe should even be as high as it is right now. I think price is about right at $65 right now. But the point is that, you know, we're way, way higher, 11 times, as you said, than we were the last time Brent was at 80. So, you know, knowing that OPEC's got all this extra production sitting around, why should a market pay 80?
Here's my reaction to this chart, Art. As I look at this, it seems to me like you're trying to draw almost a mathematical relationship between spare capacity and price. And I guess I don't see it that way from the standpoint that spare capacity has everything to do with OPEC's ability to increase production if they wanted to. And so if you're constrained, as a lot of people, and of course this is speculation and different people have different opinions, but as we go through that period after 2016-17 going into 2018, a lot of people thought that OPEC was intentionally trying to keep the price down to avoid getting the market price up to a level that would sustain a restart, if you will, of the U.S. shale revolution. And so these days, it seems pretty darn clear they want higher prices, and they're ready to welcome higher prices. They're not trying to hold the price down in order to make sure shale doesn't get restarted. So it seems to me like you can't assume there's an inverse mathematical relationship between spare capacity and price. Spare capacity puts constraints on different actors in terms of what they can do at different times, but I don't think it equates to a ratio that should determine or project price. Do we disagree on that?
Well, we don't disagree at all. And I never intended to say or imply that there's a mathematical relationship here. I'm just saying that, you know, it's a very qualitative relationship. If OPEC's got 8.5 million barrels a day sitting in its back pocket, then we don't have a shortage. And so now the question becomes, you know, what's a market willing to pay to try to get everybody else to, assuming that OPEC keeps perfect discipline, which is a whole nother conversation, but what's the market willing to pay to accomplish something, which is to say to get the rest of the world to find an additional 5, 6, 7, 8 million barrels a day that simply cannot be done in any kind of short order event. So in other words, you can keep increasing price, and it doesn't speed the process of getting more wells drilled. I mean, you get to a price where producers are making a profit, and we're there right now, and you can double the price and they can't drill wells any faster. So why would the market be willing to pay for something that basically can't be accomplished?
Well, we certainly agree that OPEC has the spare capacity that they could bring prices down if they wanted to. So,
or if they couldn't keep themselves together, if they couldn't maintain discipline.
Yes, if they were struggling to maintain the solidarity of the cartel itself, as some people feel that they are, that would be another factor. I personally don't think they're struggling as much as some people think when it comes to maintaining their solidarity and getting what they want out of the oil market. Art, let's move back to the beginning of the deck and talk about the demand picture and where it's headed. I look at demand on the right-hand side of slide number 2, and it seems like we're almost seeing by the end of 21, we're going to be back to above pre-pandemic demand levels. Is that true? And if so, why?
Well, it's a forecast. It just was published last week. This is OPEC's updated version, and they've now cranked up the demand number by a couple of million barrels a day. So it's speculative, but it does reflect OPEC's view of, how economies are recovering. And maybe it's optimistic, maybe it's not. I'm not going to try to vouch for the validity of that number. But I guess the point that I make in this chart is, Citigroup, Ed Morse just the other day said, we're going to be at record oil demand levels by the third quarter. Well, Ed needs to look at this chart and tell me how that works, because, even if you believe 99.45, we're not at the levels we were before the pandemic. You can say, well, we're only a million and a half or two below, but we're not at record demand levels. That's assuming that this chart is accurate three quarters into the future. So I guess my view is, look, demand is improving. I'm all in favor of that. I'm not trying to be, a perma bear or anything here. I'm just saying, no, demand is not going to hit records. I have a very difficult time imagining, for instance, that air travel will be anywhere near recovered by the third quarter of this year. Air travel accounts for 8 million barrels a day of consumption. I mean, that's a huge number. And so I just don't understand where these sort of glib notions or statements that demand is going to be at an all-time high. I mean, is this the pent-up demand meme? Because, if it is, you got to tell me, how we make up, and assume everything else goes back to normal. What do you do with 8 million barrels a day of jet fuel that simply isn't there? So I look at this and say, well, things are getting better. Supply-demand balance, if you believe this. And by the way, I mean, I as you know, Eric, I don't really care what the number of demand and supply is. I care like the market cares in the balance. And so the balance says 1.4 million barrels a day. Okay, that's a nice deficit. It's not a huge deficit. It's certainly not the hugest deficit we've had on this chart, which only goes back to 2018. And on this particular chart, oil was only $80 a barrel for 1 month. So again, how exactly does a similar supply-demand deficit of 1.4 somehow magically get you into the stratosphere of prices? That's really, I'm not saying it couldn't happen. I'm just saying, let's get some perspective on this. And that's what this chart provides. If we look at the next slide, which is slide number 3, this is, kind of the same comparative inventory slide that some version of which I show every time we talk. And, for those who aren't familiar with this, you can explain to people how to find out, but, on the macrovoices.com website, there, you can search for it and lots of explanations. But the bottom line here is, when I look at this chart, Eric, I see 2020 was a huge anomaly, biggest anomaly in history. And our comparative inventory went way up, price went way down, and all those green dots migrated you know, to the right and to the bottom, bottoming out where it says April, $17, just below COVID price discovery excursion, kind of steadily climb back up to 40, which is where I said all along I thought prices would balance out, stayed more or less in the $40 to $50 range until basically November, December of 2020. And then we move up to the blue, the larger blue circle is February, and the large yellow circle is March. And so basically we've just come back to where we were. We've come back to the same blue yield curve that we were on for, you know, since basically 2015, 2016, 17, 18, 19. So I look at this and I say, well, unless the market puts a completely different supply urgency on oil and it moves back up to the red curve, which hasn't ruled the market for 6 years, then we can move to as big a comparative inventory deficit as there has ever been, and we're still not going to get much above $70 a barrel WTI. Could the market change its mind and say, oh my gosh, you know, push the alarm button, you know, we're scared? Sure, it could. And we can argue about whether, you know, if OPEC keeps their solidarity, will that happen or not? I don't think it will. You think it will? Fine. But all I'm saying is, you know, looking at it where we are, where we have been for a long, long time, it just doesn't look to me like there's enough supply urgency going on to get us very far off that blue curve.
So let's talk about what you see for the rest of this year in terms of price outlook. As we're recording on Monday, a few days before our listeners will hear this, we're looking at about $63.40 or so on WTI as we're recording this. Where are we headed? What do you think the highest price we'll see this year is?
Well, you know, I'm going to say I don't know, but if we're talking WTI, I can see $70. I'm not sure that we stay at $70 very long, but you know, like I said, I mean, I don't see any reason based on where we are. I mean, gosh, the kind of inventory draw we had last week, you know, wouldn't take very many of those to get us right out near the end of this blue yield curve, which says $70. I do have a hard time right now imagining what would have to happen to get us higher. Well, I know exactly what would have to happen. I said it. You know, the market would have to fundamentally restructure the price of oil and say, we're back to 2011, 12, 13, guys. You know, there's a serious oil shortage in the world. That's what would have to happen.
So you're not sold by Goldman Sachs' $80 outlook for this year?
I can see where they're coming from, Eric. And as you know, I mean, I'm not a defender of Goldman Sachs, but I think they're smart, and I think they have a lot of credible people. I think Jeff Currie's a smart guy. If we go and look at slide number six, this is a slightly different yield curve. This is OECD minus US, and this can be a little messy, so I'm not going to apologize for its messiness, but all I did here was the color is a little different than the last one. The 2020 data here is in blue, and the blue yield curve corresponds to that. The blue yield curve in the previous one, which is the 2016 to 19, is now red. Forget about that. The three large dots above where it says 2020 yield curve, the two greens and the light blue, those are the three data points we have in 2021. And so what I did was I said, well, let's go out to where EIA, et cetera, forecast OECD minus US inventories, which is the far upper left-hand yellow circle. And let's make that $80. Let's just say that Currie and company are right. And then I just scaled everything between the present and that and back again using EIA's forecast with a scaler in there. And I said, you know, Could it be? And the answer is, yeah, it could be. Again, this is Brent, not WTI, but that's fine. It could be. But even now, things don't go back to the previous higher supply urgency kinds of yield curve geometries that we were in, you know, back when oil prices, when Brent was $110 to $125. So, you know, it tells me qualitatively that, yeah, Goldman could be right. I don't think they are, but they could be right. And we're still not going back to a situation that we lived through in, you know, the 10 years ago with oil price.
Well, Art, we've been going out of order here. I think we've covered every slide except slide number 5, which, of course, is the rig count. Let's dive into this one.
Right. So, Eric, let me just say before we talk about slide 5, let's talk a little about price formation. And so what we look at every day in the market is price discovery. Okay, so I read Bloomberg or Reuters or Platts or whatever, and the headline usually tells me oil price goes up $1.20 because of. You know, there's a causal event in the current event chronology, you know, that MBS had indigestion, or you know, there was a big draw in the US. There's always some event. And that's fine. I mean, that's what traders trade on. Okay. So that's sort of the difference between weather and climate. So price discovery, you know, trader says, well, I'll give you this if you give me that. And we play with that. And, you know, maybe price goes up for a couple of days, maybe even a week, comes back down because nobody's willing to take that price anymore. And so price discovery is part of price formation. Price formation is the way the market looks at things, not just the trading piece of it. And so when the market says, if there is a market, anthropomorphic market, which there isn't, but, you know, humor me here, market says, I think we need to raise price. Why does the market think we need to raise price? Because the market doesn't see adequate supply given the global drilling activity. And it uses price as a signal to inspire or otherwise motivate producers to get busy and drill. And so looking back over time, this chart in slide 5, it shows the U.S. oil-directed rig count. And again, you know, we can argue about whether that reflects the world or not, but it's not a bad proxy, in my opinion. And we go to May of 2016, when the rig count dropped to, again, the U.S. oil-directed rig count, all offshore, shale, everything, dropped to 319. And so the market said, okay, guys, that ain't going to cut it. We need more drilling. And so the price started to rise. And WTI price is in blue and the rig count is in orange. So the price started to rise. It eventually got to $71 WTI monthly average. I think that was probably in June or July of 2018. And sure enough, it worked. The rig count, it rose and rose and rose, and it basically tripled. It went from 319 to almost 1,000. But you look and when price increased from, say, $60 to $70, the rig count didn't follow suit. The rig count flattened out. And so the point is that increasing price after a certain point doesn't get more rigs drilling, because there's only a mechanical limit and a capital limit to how many wells can be drilled at a time. So you look at this thing, and what it says is that, you know, during that whole period of shortage from early 16 to the end of 19, you know, the average WTI price was $54. Well, 2-3 weeks ago, the Dallas Fed took a survey of 120 or so U.S. oil companies and said, what price do you need to make money? And they said $52. I don't know if that's the right number or not, but that's what they said. So we are now $13, $12, $13 above what they need to make a profit. Does increasing price beyond the point they can make money necessarily get more wells drilled? And I say, the market says, no, it doesn't. And so, you know, this is sort of like you get on an elevator and, you know, guy pushes the 10th floor and the doors haven't closed yet. And he decides to push the 10th floor again and again and again. Well, you know, the elevator has already got the signal, man. You know, pushing 10, five times, six times, seven times isn't going to get you there any faster. So the market has pushed the button. It said $65, and it can push the button over and over again. It can say $70, and it doesn't get the elevator moving any faster. The elevator's still going to get there when it gets there. And that's, to my way of thinking, that's how price formation works. It's not a capricious thing. It can't be whatever somebody thinks it can be. I mean, they can think it can be whatever they want it to be. But again, markets are cheap. Markets don't want to pay any more than they have to pay. And I think markets know that making it 80 or making it 90 doesn't get more wells drilled.
All right, let's go back to slide two and take a look at these supply and demand graphs in a little bit more detail. So you're saying that this demand projection of 99.45 or whatever the number is that's showing there for the fourth quarter of 21, that is reflective of dramatically reduced aviation. So in other words, what they're saying here is they expect a dramatic, huge, first time ever, you know, massive outperformance of demand, higher than it's ever been before adjusting it for the aviation business being slowed down. Is that realistic? I mean, why would that be? Is it because we're expecting so much else that people can't fly, so they're driving instead? I mean, I'm having a hard time reconciling this.
Yeah, I'm with you, Eric. I mean, I don't know how much, you know, how much political thinking goes into OPEC's numbers and how much it's just you know, straight technical work. But I look at, you know, the weekly data that the U.S. publishes. And I mean, last week was pretty darn interesting. I mean, aside from the, you know, the big inventory draws and everything like that, that if you just looked at product supplied, you know, how much stuff's coming out of U.S. refineries, we got to, you know, pre-COVID levels. Actually, we got a little bit higher. When you consider everything, including, you know, jet, gasoline, residual propane, distillate, other oils, all that stuff, you know, we actually got to like 105 or 106% of the difference between the 2020 minimum and the 5-year average. So, you know, we're all recovered. Everything's back to normal. Well, not exactly. And when I say not exactly, it's because the proportions of each one of those refined products is not equal. And I mean, as you know, gasoline is the biggie. I mean, gasoline's like, you know, 45% of U.S. consumption, something like residual is 1%. So, you know, they're not all equal. But I guess the point is that as I look at this thing and just look at transport fuels, because those are really, you know, what drive the thing. Looking at gasoline and diesel together, that same measure of recovery from the minimum to the 5-year average, it's 89%. Okay, that's good, but it's sure not 100%. When I look at transport fuels, including jet, so, you know, jet, gasoline, and diesel, we're at 84%. So if this were anything other than recovering from COVID, we would say this is a damn disaster. But we're so used to things being worse than bad that this looks pretty good. And so the question that, you know, that I would ask to OPEC is, how exactly is this going to work, guys? How do you get from 84% of transport fuels to something approaching 100% in, you know, what's left of the year? And I don't know the answer to that, but it seems like a stretch to me. It seems like a big stretch.
For my final question, Art, I want to stretch the timeline out quite a bit here and talk about longer term, how we see this demand and supply balance being resolved over the next decade, because a lot of people are in agreement that, look, we got to do something about changing the world's dependence on fossil fuels and electrifying the economy. There seems to be pretty darn solid consensus around doing something to make the world a less fuel-dependent place. Some people think that that means that the price of oil and finished products is going to go down dramatically because demand will be decreasing as we electrify. I tend to think this goes in the other direction, where we're going to have an energy crisis as we electrify, because those people that are still stuck on gasoline vehicles are going to be buying gasoline at a time when the investment community already moved on from petroleum production and refining, and there's not enough capacity because everybody thought it was being phased out. How do you see this? Do we end up with the last few years of petroleum being the primary energy source for the economy, with expensive petroleum or with cheap petroleum?
I read the Wood Mackenzie report that, you know, said that oil's going to be, you know, $40 a barrel by, I can't remember, 2040 or 2050, for the reasons that you just described, Eric. And you know, my comment on Twitter was, stunningly energy blind. And that's the way I look at what you're describing. Just to be clear, I take climate change very seriously. I think it's a big problem, bigger than a lot of people certainly in my oil and gas industry do. I'm completely on board with, you know, getting more aggressive with renewables and electrifying things. But then there's the pragmatic side of me that says, well, let's make sure that everybody understands what they're signing up for, because I am absolutely confident they don't. So the perception is, oh, well, this is going to be great. You know, we're just going to get rid of oil and gas and coal and all this nasty stuff, and we're going to somehow figure out, you know, how to electrify everything. And life is going to go on pretty much the way it is right now. You know, very high standards of living. I want to turn on the football game or the hockey game or the soccer game. You know, the power's there. I want to go someplace. Maybe I get in my Tesla or my Volt or something instead of, you know, my gasoline-powered car. And everything's just great. And what I'm saying is, no way. I mean, We are talking.
We know you
about,
drive a Tesla on your trips to the oil patch. All right.
Right, exactly. I drive a Ford pickup that's powered by a Tesla engine. It's just preposterous. But the point, Eric, is that what people have to understand is that an electric world has a much smaller multiplier effect of productivity. And so if I'm running the world on electricity that is increasingly powered by sun and wind, then my productivity factor is, you know, a tenth or 20% or maybe 30% of oil, gas, and coal. And that's great. But you can't get the same amount of work done. I've talked to you before and others about, you know, there's 4.5 years of joules or calories in a barrel of oil. And there's just, you know, by any arithmetic that you can imagine, there just isn't anything else as dense as oil that we know of right now in the world. And you want to go to a less dense energy source, you can do that. But you better expect lower productivity output. What does that mean in simple terms? It means basically you're not going to have economic growth. There's just no way that the economy can grow. I mean, the economy before oil, gas, and coal, the world was basically in a subsistence economy. And everybody was fine with that. Well, I mean, there's a lot of poverty, but people were generally fine with that because that's all they knew. And all of a sudden, I mean, the Industrial Revolution was much more of an energy revolution than it was anything else. The technology simply was what it always is. It's a way of getting energy into work. And so what really happened was that with 4.5 years of human labor and a barrel of oil, no matter what the price of gasoline is, you can just do a whole bunch more for a whole lot less than you ever could before. And that's what made the world economy grow the way that it has, particularly since World War II. And if people expect to phase out that, you know, that super adrenaline boost that you get from fossil energy into something that gives you, you know, not even a very good buzz, then you're wrong. And again, I'm not arguing whether it's a good thing or a bad thing. It's just physics. And so what I fear is that people are going to commit to this because that's the direction we're going. And then when they find out that, gee, not only isn't the economy growing, it's flat or it's even declining. Well, you know, where's our Trump or Bolsonaro now to get rid of all these corrupt elites that lied to us? I mean, how many people who support renewable energy would also agree to support zero economic growth? I don't think very many, certainly not in the rank and file. So, you know, back to your question, can we somehow retire 350 million gasoline and diesel burning vehicles in the United States in the time frame that people think we can? No way. And if you're right, Eric, and that the supply diminishes because there's no investment, then gasoline and diesel become very expensive and people are going to be pissed for a different reason.
Well, Art, I can't thank you enough for another terrific interview. Before I let you go, tell us a little bit more about artberman.com. There's a free blog there, which I strongly recommend that everybody subscribe to. What else can they find there?
Yeah, so aside from the blog, Eric, there are a number of relatively low-price subscription options. So I publish a weekly oil storage and comparative inventory report that gives you, you know, 10 or 15 charts and my latest insight. There's a similar product for natural gas storage and comparative inventory. And then there's a monthly newsletter that gives you sort of the high-level view of how things that have happened this month affect where oil and energy are taking us. And, you know, all of those, you know, any of those products, you know, like the newsletter costs you something like $200 a year. It's not a super expensive thing. That's what artberman.com is. And most of the raw material is posted on Twitter. If you want to take the cheap seats, it'd be, you know, sort of hard to put it all together without my interpretation, but I don't hold back too much in terms of putting my data out there.
Well, Art, we look forward to getting you back on the show in a few months for another update. Patrick Ceresna and I will be back as Macro Voices continues right after this message from our sponsor. Looking for exposure to rising silver and gold prices? Abra Silver Resource Corporation, ticker ABRA on TSX Venture Exchange and ABBRF in the United States, is rapidly emerging as one of the premier silver and gold-focused exploration companies. Abra Silver has an advanced stage project with a large resource base of over 140 million ounces on a silver equivalent basis and has recently announced several very high-grade silver and gold drill results, with more results pending. Abra Silver is very well funded with a strong shareholder base and excellent exploration upside potential. Visit abrasilver.com for more information. That's A-B-R-A silver.com for more information on this silver and gold exploration stock.
Now, back to your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna.
Eric, it was great to have Art back on to give us an update on where he stands on these oil markets. Where do your opinions differ from his?
Well, I guess where I see the main difference is I don't hear Art talking about secular inflation as a driver of commodities generally higher. And I think that's a big part of the story. And frankly, I think that's the reason that we saw Art's $65 end of year oil price target realized so much earlier than it was intended. So I think that that's a big driving factor in the market. Now, Art is still saying that he expects a reduction of U.S. production. It sounds like he doesn't think that's going to drive prices markedly higher. I think it's a little bit of a crapshoot here, Patrick. You know, we do definitely have a growing concern in the market that, hey, people have realized just because there are vaccines, that doesn't mean that the pandemic is over. It's not time to forget about it. There really is still an issue here. There are a lot of people, I think, that are taking pause, but I think that we are going to see another significant leg higher. That's the one place where Art and I disagree. I think the way Art sees it is his comparative inventory model is telling him this is where prices should be. We already got there. The market's already gotten us to where the price is supposed to be. It's not probably going much higher. I think that may be true in terms of just the oil fundamentals that are driving it. But when you consider the macro drivers as well, I think all commodity prices, including oil, are moving much higher. And that's based on a secular inflation view. If it turns out that we're wrong about secular inflation, then for sure, Art's going to be right about prices having maybe already topped out or close to topped out for this year. I don't think it's going to go that way, though. We'll see what happens. But Patrick, what I want to do right now is dive a little bit deeper into some charts and look at these energy markets, both the commodity as well as the stocks in the energy production sector. Listeners, you'll find the chart deck linked in your research roundup email. If you don't have a research roundup email, it means you're not registered yet at macrovoices.com. Just go to our homepage, click the red button that says looking for the downloads. Patrick, the title of the slide deck is Scanning the Energy Markets. Scan away, my friend.
All right. Well, you know what? I wanted to take a deeper dive into the entire energy complex just beyond looking at oil alone. But even on page two, the first thing we start off with is that oil chart. And we were just talking about it in the at the start of the show during the market wrap. And you were talking about that you didn't think that there was enough pain yet for a lot of the oil traders off the highs. And I find it really interesting when we look at this chart. What I did is put the volume profiling to show where all the highest volume consolidations have actually happened. And we're right now in this pocket in between, you can round it to this kind of $59 to $64 range where much of the consolidation has occurred. And I find it interesting that we're right in that pocket. And it continues to be like a really important point from to find out which way this market breaks higher. Now, I've been suspect that there's room for us to temporarily dip below 60 and below that 50-day moving average as we, you know, could potentially correct down into the mid-50s on just a little kind of a washout of short-term traders before we get an upside. But when we get through the rest of the charts, it's really interesting that many of the other markets have already engaged in this deeper correction, and oil really has not played along. It'll be interesting to see whether this ends up just being a big sideways consolidation in oil, and then somehow a new bull breakout ensues off of that. And so I'm definitely watching that 50-day moving average in this consolidation zone, and it'll be really interesting to see if oil could put together a meaningful breakout above 64. What's your take on that?
Patrick, something I've noticed about oil markets is when you see a sideways consolidation, and a perfect example of this is the one that we had last summer. When you see that sideways consolidation where the market's going to trade sideways for a while and then it's going to move higher, usually what happens is the lowest point in that consolidation, the lowest print that you get, comes right at the end, and then it's all uphill from there. We didn't get that this time. We did get a last dip lower, if you will, that we had last week, but it wasn't all the way back down to that 57 spot 24 or whatever the number was from a couple of weeks ago. We haven't had that one last push to a new low, which usually would be, you know, what I would think of is where the consolidation ends and where the uptrend begins. Just, you know, what we've seen here, it's been way too comfortable for me and for the other oil bulls. I don't feel like the weak hands have been shaken out of this market yet. It feels to me like it's still coming.
Well, you know, what I wanted to do is on page three, talk about the actual crude oil term structure. And obviously, there's a lot of periods where crude oil trades in backwardation, but this is a very clear backwardation. There's not even a little bit of contango at the front of the curve. It's just straight down where the belly of the curve going 3-4 years out is still $50 oil. How do you interpret this? And why do you think it's so steep? Or is it steep? Am I just misreading it?
Well, Patrick, let's start by refreshing our listeners' memory on the term structure chart and how it works, because not everybody who is not a commodities trader really has seen this type of chart. Each one of those little yellow dots is the current price of a different crude oil contract. The first dot at the left is the May delivery contract. That's the front month, as we call it, because it's at the front of the queue there. And then each subsequent contract has a price. And if you go 5 years in the future, as you say, the price is only $50 or so. The difference between any 2 months, the 1 month spread, there's a lot of history that I've done a lot of work in analyzing. And, you know, you can easily get to a dollar, dollar and a half per month of backwardation right at the peak backwardation level, which is usually between 6 and 12 months into the future. That's as, you know, if you start looking at a dollar and a half of backwardation, that's where you say, okay, this has gone about as far as it could possibly go. We're at like 50, well, we were at 50 to 60 cents per month of backwardation at the peak. And right now we're back to 25 to 40 cents, depending on which month you're looking at. The maximum amount of backwardation between any 2 months right now, as I look at another live chart on my screen here, is 44 cents. So, you know, we're getting there, but this is not super extreme backwardation by any stretch. And again, what drives backwardation is expectations of tightening supply. And I think that we are going to get more expectations of tightening supply after we burn through the excesses that have existed and we start to run into not as much supply because of not as much investment in new production. All of that eventually unwinds and you get really steep backwardation before this is over. I don't think we've seen the max backwardation by any stretch of the imagination yet.
So, Eric, I just wanted to, on page four, just touch on Brent oil, because we talk a lot about WTI, and we haven't really shown a chart on Brent oil for a while. But really, what I find interesting is that if you go back for the last couple of years, Brent oil and WTI have actually diverged numerous times due to whatever fundamentals. But really, one thing I've noticed is since the November lows till about now, really the two have been trading lockstep. There haven't been any major divergences between the two. And it'll be really interesting to see whether that continues or whether the fundamentals between the two start to actually have each kind of start marching to the beat of its own drum. But right now, anyway, Brent has been more or less trading in line. But this is where I wanted to go to chart five and look at gasoline futures. And like a month back, I was showing a chart where gasoline has actually been materially outperforming WTI on the upside. We just had a huge surge in gasoline futures. But what's interesting here is that gasoline really has calmed down. We haven't seen any deep, deep pullback here yet. I was suspect that we could see gasoline futures dipping even as low as like 175. But really, at this stage, it has had a very similar consolidation to that of oil itself, which is it's holding above its 50-day moving averages. It's more or less trading sideways in this pocket. And this kind of $2 area for gasoline futures seems to be really where we're pivoting off. It'll be really interesting to see whether or not gasoline can break out from here.
Yeah, and something I'm just watching, I'm looking at another chart as we speak. We've already moved below most of the short-term moving averages. The big hurdle that's left is the 55-day moving average, which is about where you've got the 50-day drawn on this chart. We're above it right now, but only by a little bit. If we got a daily close below that, it would open the door to a much bigger move lower. So that's going to be what I'm watching for, is the first sign that maybe we are about to see a move to a new lower low in terms of crude oil prices.
Right. And so on page six, just to continue with that, it was I have the RBOB gasoline crack spreads, which is sort of the profit margin and one would consider for a lot of these refiners of turning oil into gasoline. And this is just went roaring higher because of those that rise in gasoline prices. And it's really interesting that this is just not let up. Right now, these crack spreads continue to stay up along the top end of these ranges. And it'll be really interesting to see whether this stays there and whether that means like we'll in a few minutes we'll just be looking here actually at the chart on the refiners and they've been pulling back but this chart hasn't. It'll be interesting to see whether that proves as a buy on dip opportunity on many of these refining stocks.
Let's take a look at natural gas on page seven.
Right. And so natural gas, has, at least on the surface, appears to have been far more trade range bound than crude oil over the last 6 months. But what is interesting is that the recent pullback in nat gas, this is a continuous futures contract. So it had as much to do with the rolling along the term structure of nat gas as it did with actual real spot prices of gas. What's interesting is when we look on page eight, one can see the term structure of nat gas, which has far more waves of the seasonality of natural gas going a decade out is being reflected in these ups and downs. But what is clear is that we sort of rolled down the term structure from a seasonality perspective, and we're now looking at a scenario where this continuous contract is going to be rolling up the term structure right now, pricing in a December contract as high as $3.20. And so it looks like at least from this chart perspective that we probably have seen the lower boundaries of natural gas and we should see it progressing back towards those November and February highs as we get into the third and fourth quarters of the year.
Let's move on to the actual energy stocks using the XLE ETF as a proxy for them.
Right. I want to go through a whole series of these different ETFs that represent the different oil sectors. And this particular one, the XLE, is sort of the best one that encompasses the majors, the fully integrated oil names that have those big juicy dividends. And really what we can see here is that they've been pulling back and they have actually been making lower lows. And the pullback has been very pronounced in the energy stock sector ever since that March high. But what's interesting is that when we go and compare that to the XOP, which is the Spider Oil and Gas Exploration and Production ETF, this has been an even deeper pullback. I mean, we've seen this ETF pull back from $92 down to a low of $72 during this consolidation. And so what's interesting is that while we've seen those charts on oil and gas actually holding up in the futures market, really these energy stocks have really gone through a deeper and more meaningful pullback that is now longer than a month in duration. It'll be really interesting to see that now that we get many of these pulling back this deep, whether this actually proves as a meaningful buy on dip opportunity on many of these energy names.
Patrick, moving on to slide 11, we've got OSX, the oil services ETF. That, of course, includes companies like Halliburton and Schlumberger that provide services to drilling and exploration and refining companies. What are we looking at here?
Right. And this is actually where the correction has even been the deepest. Just a very pronounced pullback in oil service stocks. And we're slowly approaching a 200-day moving average, including where the December and January consolidations all developed. And so now that this pullback has occurred as deep as it has, watching those Schlumbergers and the Halliburtons is going to be really interesting. Well, the other one that's also interesting to look at is on page 12, where I have the actual oil refiners themselves. That's we're using the ETF CRAK, C-R-A-K. And this has actually held up pretty well. But this ETF doesn't actually reflect some of the deeper pullbacks that we've seen in like the Phillips 66 and the Holly Frontiers of the world. With the fact that CRAK spreads are holding up as much as they are, it's curious whether this is going to be a place where there's going to be relative strength or outperformance relative to the other oil areas or sectors sectors in there. And finally, Eric, what I wanted to touch on page 13 is the Alerian MLP ETF. And what's interesting is the MLPs, like the midstream oil pipeline kind of storylines, which we've had Variant Perception guys come on to our podcast and talk about the space, they've actually held up very well. And this ETF is working along its 52-week highs, but and that's reflective of those stocks like Magellan, which are the big giants in these ETFs. But when you go to some of the individual names like the BP Midstream or Phillips 66 Midstream or Shell Midstream, some of them are actually breaking to 52-week highs when they have these big juicy dividends and that they pay out, distributions anyway that they pay out. It's really interesting that this particular space has not really been impacted by the correction and continues to do very well.
And listeners, you can get Patrick's graphs and charts not just once a week, but every single day with a free trial of Big Picture Trading. You'll find the information for signing up on page 14 or just go to bigpicturetrading.com. Folks, we're going to leave it there for this week's show. This episode is brought to you by Abex Technologies, pioneering the design of smarter markets that better meet the needs of both market participants and society as a whole. And by Abra Silver Resource Corporation, a premier emerging silver and gold exploration company. Ticker ABRA on TSX Venture and ABBRF in the United States. Patrick, what's in this week's Research Roundup?
Well, today you're going to find the transcript for today's interview as well as a link to Art's slide deck and the charts we just discussed in the post game. There's also a link to an article on the energy sector seeing a blowout quarter as well as a link to a Variant Perception article on the U.S. overheating risk. So you'll find this and so much more in this week's Research Roundup. That does it for this week's episode. We appreciate all the feedback and support we get from our listeners, and we're always looking for suggestions on how we can make the program even better. Now, for those of our listeners that write or blog about the markets and would like to share that content with our listeners, send us an email at researchroundup@macrovoices.com or tag it with the MVRR hashtag on Twitter, and we will consider it for our weekly distributions. If you have not already, follow our main Twitter account @macrovoices for all the most recent updates and releases. You can also follow Eric on Twitter @EricSTownsend. That's Eric spelled with a K, and myself @PatrickSaresna. On behalf of Eric Townsend and myself, thank you for listening. And we'll see you all next week.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com, the internet's premier source of online education for traders. Please visit BigPictureTrading.com for more information. Please register your free account at MacroVoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly Research Roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the internet each week. You'll also gain access to our free listener discussion forums and research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we'll be able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week free of charge. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer your questions on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts Eric Townsend and Patrick Saresna shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com and by funding from Fourth Turning Capital Management, LLC. For more information, visit MacroVoices.com.